Can I first of all welcome everybody? We've got past 1 o'clock and the fire alarm hasn't gone off, which it normally does when it's being tested, so I'm grateful for that. Today we've got what I hope is going to be a very interesting discussion. We have three very good participants on the panel, and I will introduce them in a moment. Can I just tell you how this discussion will operate? I'm going to ask each of our panellists to speak on the topic of the debate for 8 minutes, or no more than 8 minutes. If they want to do it more briefly, they're entitled to. And then we will have 10 minutes in which I will ask them if they want to pick up each other's points and have a discussion within the panel itself. And then I will open it to the floor and everybody can either ask questions or make comments. The subject of today's debate, I think, is a very interesting one. It goes back to the statement that was made 10 years ago about the need for an ethical dimension to Britain's foreign policy. And the question being asked today of the panellists is, 10 years on, what has happened to the ethical dimension in British foreign policy? We have, as our panellists, Sir Malcolm Rifkind, who needs no introduction, a former Foreign Secretary, a colleague of mine in Parliament, and also at one time we both were Edinburgh MPs together, but that was many years ago. We've known each other for a long time, and I'm sure that he will have a very interesting contribution to make. We have Oliver Cam, who is an author and Times columnist. His writings have also appeared in The Guardian, Prospect, The New Republic, and many other publications. He was a contributor to Britain's Bomb, What Next?, which came out in 2006, and he is a founder and partner of an asset management and advisory firm called WMG Advisors LLP, which is based in London. And then finally we have Carl Ross, who is the founder and director of Independent Diplomat, the world's first non-profit diplomatic advisory group. It has offices in four major diplomatic centres, and it advises disadvantaged governments and political groups on diplomatic strategy and technique. Khan is also the author of the recently published Independent Diplomat, Dispatches from an Unaccountable Elite. He has an interesting background in that after 15 years of service, he resigned from the Foreign Office in 2004 after giving evidence to the Butler Inquiry on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. His last job at the Foreign Office was as the UK's Iraq expert on the UN Security Council, where he was responsible for negotiating resolutions on sanctions and weapons inspections. So without more ado, I'm going to ask our three speakers to give their contributions. I'm going to first of all ask Sir Malcolm Rifkind, then I'm going to ask Carl Ross, and finally I'm going to ask Oliver Cam to speak for 8 minutes. Malcolm Rifkind.
Thank you very much indeed, Michael. First of all, I think it's very appropriate that this discussion on an ethical foreign policy should be taking place in these hallowed precincts of the National Liberal Club, because I suspect in some ways you could almost see Mr. Gladstone as the originator of the argument that the ethical dimension has to be a dominant part of our foreign policy. He was a very strange man, Mr. Gladstone. Those of you who have read Roy Jenkins' biography of Gladstone may be able to remember that he made a reference to the one reported comment that Mrs. Gladstone is ever supposed to have made about her husband, where she apparently said, "You know, William, if you weren't such a great man, you'd be an awful bore." In fact, the only reason we know about that remark is because he actually wrote it in his own diary that night, which shows the accuracy of the observation. Now, to an ethical dimension of foreign policy, and the implications and what we have seen over the last 10 years. The starting point has to be that when Robin Cook made these remarks, ultimately it was bogus. It was bogus not because there isn't an ethical dimension in foreign policy, but because in recent times in Western countries, it is always and always has been part of the foreign policy consideration of any responsible government. In the modern world, for a country like the United Kingdom or any other, certainly Western country, and many countries in other parts of the world, you form your alliances most comfortably with countries that share your values. We do believe that countries with strong human rights and rule of law dimension are less likely to be aggressive, and there's all sorts of self-interested reasons why we wish to encourage human rights around the world. And that's always been true, and was true of all previous governments to that of which Mr. Cook was a member. But of course, what Robin was trying to imply as a political point was that the Blair government would attach a much greater importance to human rights and to ethical considerations than its predecessors. Now, there has always been a tension between the ethical dimension and the question of the national interests of a country. And you know, no one in their right mind would argue that human rights must always take priority. During the Second World War, one of our closest allies was Stalin, the ghastly dictator of the Soviet Union. And why was Stalin an ally? Because he also was seeking to defeat Adolf Hitler. And in certain circumstances, my enemy's enemy has to be my friend, even if it's only for a temporary and specific purpose. So there was nothing unethical, except in the absolute sense, of the alliance with Stalin's Russia in order to defeat Hitler. In a much more limited way today, the controversy about our relations with Parvez Musharraf of Pakistan or with Saudi Arabia has given rise to much criticism, but is it seriously being suggested that we should break all relationships with Saudi Arabia or Pakistan, regardless of the damage that might do to our attempts to defeat the by far greater threat from Al-Qaeda or from terrorism to which these countries are an important and close ally? So these are the practical questions that any government, including the Blair government or the Brown government, has to deal with. And that is why there is a certain bogus and hollow quality to the very debate itself. But let us assume that the Blair government's objective was to say, but we will give a higher priority to human rights. And if one looks at the events of the last 10 years, three events stand out: Sierra Leone, Iraq, Kosovo. Let me just briefly comment on each of these. Sierra Leone, I have no difficulty in saying the government acted sensibly and wisely. Here was an opportunity, by making a modest contribution of military force, to transform the human rights situation in Sierra Leone, and to do so without any significant geopolitical implications, either in that country or in the region, or to wider interests in the world. So a lot of people benefited from a change in the political circumstances in Sierra Leone as a result of the intervention by the United Kingdom. I would like to believe any British government would have done that, and I'd certainly pay tribute to the Blair government for having done so. Then we come to Iraq. Now, of course, the official line on Iraq in this country was always weapons of mass destruction. It would have been difficult for it to have been human rights because the United Nations Charter would not have permitted human rights to be an argument for regime change and for going to war with another country. But even if you accept whatever the Charter says, the government today essentially argues the case for its Iraq policy on human rights grounds, then Iraq is itself a very good example of how dangerous an assumption that is. Because even if you bend over backwards to give all credit to the government in terms of its intent, its objectives, its honourable desires, even assuming all that, we see that on the one hand the removal of a ghastly Saddam Hussein regime, but on the other hand, hundreds of thousands of people who have died since the end of that war as a result of the carnage in Iraq, millions who have fled Iraq, the collapse of Iraq into internal anarchy, the emergence of Iran as the regional superpower in a way that the United States and the United Kingdom never intended. So Iraq is not exactly a particularly attractive example of how you can boost human rights by intervening in the way that we saw. But I think in some ways the most serious example, and it's very topical today of all days, is Kosovo. And you know, the road to Baghdad started in Belgrade. And when one looks at the policy that was pursued by the Blair government and by the United States government at that time, of course people have different views as to what was really behind the decision to go to war over Kosovo 10 years ago. Some argue it was nothing to do with human rights, it was simply because NATO needed to have a role, it needed to have a purpose, and this was a way of showing that. But let's put that on one side. Let us assume that human rights was the primary consideration. I think there are at least four reasons why it was turned out to have been, and was predicted to be by many people at that time, a very, very unwise and very dangerous policy. First of all, effectively, although war was never declared, we actually went to war, both Britain and NATO, with a country that had never attacked any NATO member, was never threatening any NATO member, and without United Nations authority. Pretty dangerous sort of precedent. We bombed Belgrade for 60, 70 days. We effectively were at war with a country that had not attacked us. And the grounds for doing so was the human rights situation in Kosovo. But simultaneously, Moscow was destroying Chechnya. Simultaneously, we had a policy within the Russian Federation, infinitely worse, because Grozny was essentially being razed to the ground. And yet, not only was there no attempt to equate the two, but of course, in some ways, there was almost an acquiescence in what was happening in Chechnya. So both the legal and the political issues were very, very doubtful. But that's not the only consideration, because you could say, well, because we couldn't intervene in Chechnya, was not an argument for not intervening in Kosovo. But there, too, I'm afraid, the consequences turn out, when you go into a war of that kind, to be very you lose control of events. The objective was to prevent ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. There had been some significant, serious displacement, ethnic cleansing, before the NATO bombardment of Belgrade began. But I don't think there's any serious dispute that the vast majority of people ethnically cleansed by the Serbs, that began during the fog of war, that began during the bombardment, when Milosevic used the conflict as a means of trying to achieve his objectives while the conflict was going on. So that itself was not something that NATO wanted or intended, but it will always be arguable whether Milosevic would have been able to act in that way without that particular opportunity. Thirdly, of course, the consequence of the end of the war was the displacement of the Serb minority in Kosovo. They were ethnically cleansed, and a very large proportion of them remain so today. That, too, is a very serious consequence. But the final point, and I appreciate my time has run out, the final point is perhaps the most serious, that when NATO went to war, it did so on the basis that it would respect the territorial integrity of Serbia. This was all about autonomy for Kosovo. That is actually what the United Nations resolution referred to. Through no fault of NATO's, from the moment that war happened, the whole issue changed. The Kosovars, and I don't blame them, said this is the one historical opportunity we will ever have to get complete independence. And so that is now effectively what the West is being urged to concede and to offer. It simply demonstrates, my very final sentence, it simply demonstrates that when you launch a war, and particularly when you launch one without real international support, either from the Security Council or from the international community as a whole, you then lose control of events. And the consequence of having done so can sometimes be dramatically different to what you intended. It's what happened in Iraq, it's what's happened in Kosovo, and it ought to be a very important warning. Whatever we think about Serbia, Kosovo, and the other issues, it ought to be a terrible warning to international statesmen to think very hard, to look before they leap. Thank you.
I'm going to call on Khan Ross. Do you want this, to use this or not?
Yeah, actually I would, thanks. The poem that I read out at my wedding was Auden's Leap Before You Look, so I guess I'm going to take a slightly different perspective. But if you wanted somebody who is cynical about ethical foreign policy, or who might be cynical about ethical foreign policy, you would do well to pick me, because not only did I resign after the Iraq War, but also before Robin Cook's ethical foreign policy speech, I was speechwriter to the Foreign Secretary, this one, and then Robin Cook. And after the ethical foreign policy speech, I was no longer speechwriter to the Foreign Secretary. I was summarily ejected from that role and replaced. So I would perhaps have a particular reason for feeling bitter about ethical foreign policy. And indeed, I think there are many reasons to be cynical about it. Reasons for doubt about the concept from Sir Malcolm. In the speech itself, it fails to define the word ethical, which, like the word moral, requires definition if it is to have any meaning at all. Indeed, the phrase ethical foreign policy doesn't even occur in the speech, a bit like Douglas Hurst's phrase that Britain should box above its weight, a phrase that actually never passed his lips. Neither did the phrase ethical foreign policy ever pass the lips of Robin Cook. This isn't the only reason to be cynical. One could point to the rank inconsistency of British foreign policy in places like Saudi Arabia or Pakistan, its craven inaction over Palestine. One could argue that Britain is only ethical when it suits it and when it costs it nothing in places like Zimbabwe or Burma where even more simply you could argue that Britain is only ethical when it is ineffective. Above all, one could argue and point at the damage, enormous damage done by the Iraq War to the concept of ethics in foreign policy. One could point to the numbers of dead Iraqis, above all. One could point to the infinite and many and still to be played out ramifications of that terrible disaster on the state of the world, where today Khartoum, this odious government, can argue that intervention by UN force in Darfur should be stopped and slowed down, and has been successful in hindering such a deployment for many years, garnering support amongst its allies on the grounds that the West wants another Iraq, wants to invade another Muslim country, a grotesque distortion, but one that has some currency because of the distortions that themselves preceded the Iraq War. These are all grounds for cynicism. Indeed, such, I think, is the cynicism today. The phrase ethics in foreign policy is a bit of a joke, and one can look at two recent expositions of the debate in British politics today on foreign policy, what our foreign policy should be, and you'll find scant mention of the word ethics. I think of two particular speeches, one by Gordon Brown to the Mansion House, where he coined the phrase hard-headed internationalism. Another, David Cameron's speech, where he rephrased humanitarian intervention as, I think, liberal interventionism. I dare say, in passing, these two speeches were some of the worst examples of contributions to the debate on foreign policy I've ever seen. Both remarkably free of content, both remarkably unimaginative in how we address the manifold problems of the world today, both remarkably prone to cliché and superficiality in addressing and talking about our many challenges that we face in foreign policy. I was very depressed, frankly, to see both of them. So what, one may ask, is left in the receding tide of the idea of ethical foreign policy? And I think we can have no doubt that that tide is receding today. And I think there is something that rivals cynicism. There is something that Robin Cook gave to us in this speech. And that is the idea that foreign policy should be about something more than national interests, a concept with which I've always had a problem because it seems to me arbitrarily defined by people like me in the Foreign Office or my colleagues here, without much reference to the people in whose name we are acting. I think that partly because I cast my mind back to more than 10 years ago to the war in Bosnia, when you would hear our foreign secretary today, Douglas Hurd, sneer at those he called the Something Must Be Done Brigade, who were calling, how dare they call for such a thing, for intervention to stop genocide in Bosnia. I remember those days with shame as a British diplomat. I'm glad to say that those days are behind us. I think there is a residue from ethical foreign policy left behind from this speech, and indeed from the inconsistencies and hypocrisy of Labour foreign policy. And that residue is that the suffering of others, be it genocide or gross humanitarian suffering or oppression of one group over another, is something that we should care about. And for that, I think I am grateful, and I personally think the world should be grateful.
Thank you very much. Finally, I'm going to call on Oliver Cam.
Thank you, Michael. I've debated with both of my distinguished fellow panellists in the not-too-distant past, and I can certainly say there will not be consensus among us now any more than there was then, except there was actually consensus between Malcolm and me the last time we spoke. I, first of all, would point to the very words used by the late Robin Cook. They were not, as Khan said, an ethical foreign policy. They were foreign policy with an ethical dimension. And the point is worth stressing. I would not have expected Michael Ancram to be anything other than scrupulously accurate in his title for this debate. And those are the words used by Robin Cook. I think it's important distinguishing foreign policy with an ethical dimension from the intolerably sanctimonious notion of an ethical foreign policy. The point is illustrated, perhaps, as many foreign policy debates were, by that coterie of American intellectuals in the middle of the last century, and one of them in particular, Walter Lippmann, who in his youth was the architect of several of the 14 points of President Wilson in defense of the concept of the League of Nations and collective security. Lippmann turned against Wilsonian foreign policy. He took the view that the idea of instilling ethical standards into your consideration of foreign policy is like the advice given by a father to a young son. The young son turns for guidance to his father, and the father says, "Go forwards." It is a vacuous, meaningless phrase that gives no practical guidance to your actions. And similarly, do good, behave morally, is not a practical course in foreign affairs. And Lippmann wrote, just before the Second World War, a book that has greatly influenced considerations of US foreign policy ever since, American Foreign Policy, Shield of the Republic, in which he argued that the great dilemma in foreign policy is that you need to match your commitments with the resources available. You need to match ends and means. And after the Wilsonian intervention in the affairs of the Republic, the foreign policy of the Republic, so Lippmann argued, there had been this mismatch between ends and means. And ever since, it has been paramount in foreign policy as the United States has taken a greater and greater role in world affairs, has become the one superpower, the provider of global public goods. It has become ever more important that there be, in any regional or global intent, a match of ends and means. I take the view, unlike my colleagues on the panel, that the aim of a foreign policy with an ethical dimension is a reputable and to a large extent successful way of coping with this dilemma in foreign policy. There is absolute imperative to ensure that we marshal our resources for the struggles that really matter. And we do not expend our treasure, and particularly the blood and efforts of our servicemen, in conflicts that can be taken on by others, but that we marshal our resources for the conflicts that really do matter. In the Cold War, the struggle against totalitarianism, and now in the 21st century, the struggle against a new form of totalitarianism, a theocratic fanaticism that, were it to gain control of a state, as it did in the case of a third world state, a very underdeveloped state, Afghanistan, were it to gain control of a state with far greater technological resources, would be an existential threat, if not to us, then to the neighbours of that state, to our allies. I take the view that the record of the new Labour government has been broadly a creditable one in matching means and ends. Let me explain why I take that view. I think that the great issue of the 21st century, that of Islamist fanaticism, has focused our attention on what is our main goal in foreign policy, to contain that threat in an arc from Northern Africa through to Afghanistan. After 9/11, after these terrible attacks, there was much talk in public debate of the root causes of what had precipitated these terrible acts. And in the case of most commentators, it appeared that the root cause of Islamist fanaticism turned out to be whatever the commentator had focused on in the first place, whether it be global inequality, injustice, the very pressing issue of a necessary resolution of the Israel-Palestinian conflict. But if you look at the global conjuncture, the fact that the greatest threat from terrorism doesn't come from the poorest regions of the world, it doesn't come from sub-Saharan Africa, it comes from the Middle East. If you consider the economic evidence that the greatest correlation of variables with Islamist terrorism is not poverty, it is an absence of liberty, there comes this need, on grounds of strategic self-interest and not merely of an ethical dimension, to spread democracy, to spread democratic reform in a region that is absolutely crucial to our security. the one where Islamist terrorism takes root and burgeons. And this, I think, is the thing that Tony Blair perceived more accurately than any other world statesman immediately after 9/11, that there was no link, as the Bush administration rather disingenuously made out, between the terrorists of 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. But there was a link between the terrorism of 9/11 and this slum of autocratic states throughout the region, this dysfunctional set of regimes, whereby no political dissent was possible except through that part of civil society that remained relatively untouched, the mosque. It is this correlation between a lack of political liberty and the burgeoning of theocratic terrorism that is our principal security dilemma in the Western democracies as we are at the moment. And it was for that reason, I believe, that the interventions — I won't have time in these comments, but I will come back to Malcolm's comment about Kosovo — the principal intervention in the 21st century during the period of new Labour government seemed to be most pressing, that of intervening to overthrow a transplanted Islamist group in Afghanistan and dealing with this heinous regime in Iraq. There were very good security reasons as well as ethical reasons for intervening to overthrow the Taliban. It was, in effect, the only way of getting to the people directly responsible for 9/11. The 9/11 Commission concluded that Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan had directly recruited the hijackers, not the hijackers who flew the planes into the Twin Towers, but the muscle hijackers, those that restrained the passengers, apart from those heroes who brought down one of those planes. To ask the Taliban to repatriate Osama bin Laden would have been like asking the Taliban to repatriate Lord Lucan. It was entirely out with their powers to do so. This symbiotic relationship between a parasite and a host made it imperative that we intervene on grounds of our own national security. The failures of the intervention in Iraq could take all of this debate, and I am very well aware of them. But there are two failures in this debate that I think should not be laid on the should not be attributed to the Blair government or to the maladministration of the Bush administration. One is the idea that we would have been better served by seeking a stable balance of power in the region, a policy whose earlier failure may be gauged by the fact that at one time it extended even so far as Saddam Hussein itself. And secondly, the idea that there was no link between Iraq and the terrorist threat that we now face. And I've already explained, I think there was an absolutely integral link, which is the need to spread on grounds of ethics and on grounds of strategic self-interest democratic reform throughout a region that currently represents our greatest strategic threat. And on those grounds and on many others, I believe that the record of foreign policy with an ethical dimension — not an ethical foreign policy with an ethical dimension — is an idea that has a creditable record and must not be lost now that the Blair government recedes into history.
Thank you very much. Well, we've had three very good distinctive views there, which is sometimes unusual in a panel like this. So I'm going to ask each of the panellists whether they would like to challenge or take up any points made. Malcolm.
If I may, just two brief points. First of all, to Oliver, I think he's wrong to use Afghanistan as an argument in terms of an ethical foreign policy. I think the government were right, the Americans were right to intervene in Afghanistan. I happen to support that policy. It was done, essentially, it was a form of self-defense. America had been attacked. The only way to deal with the cause of that attack was to eliminate the Taliban regime in ways that we know very, very well. I don't think anyone argued it on human rights grounds. So far as what Khan said, there's only one point I would take issue with what you said, Khan. You argued that with all its faults, at least what Robin Cook said, what the Labour government said 10 years ago, represented in some way a change of policy, that it was necessary to have an ethical dimension and not simply national interest. And you used Bosnia as your reason for coming to that view. Now, you're entitled to your view on the Bosnian policy. What I don't think you're entitled to say is that the previous government that not only Douglas Hurd — I was Defence Secretary at the time, so I was as much involved as Douglas in that policy — what you're not entitled to say is that there was no ethical dimension. Why else did we have 30,000 British, French, Dutch and other Western European troops in Bosnia, escorting convoys, helping save hundreds of thousands of Bosnian lives through food, through medicine, through aid. There might be an argument that we should have done more, but there was no national self-interest reason to have 30,000 troops in Bosnia for several years. And of course, the reason we did not go beyond that and actually take sides in that war by actually becoming combat troops was because there was no one, not even the United States or the Labour Party or anyone in this country, apart from a few individuals, who argued that there should be an intervention as a combat force in Bosnia. This was ultimately seen as a civil war or formed civil war, and which was not susceptible of being dealt with by military intervention. Now, we can argue whether that was right or wrong. What you cannot argue is that there was not an ethical dimension to the Bosnian policy. It may not have been enough, but it was there. There was no other reason for having all these British and French and other troops in that country for several years.
Khan, do you want to respond to that and raise
sure,
anything you'd like to?
I accept that point. I would say it went a bit further, of course. British policy was actually also to support an arms embargo,
yes,
which the Bosnian Muslims said prevented them from having the arms to defend themselves against a genocidal Serb force armed with the weapons of the former Yugoslav National Army. So in fact, it could be argued that British policy was actually preserving an unbalanced. You've heard these arguments before, and you've had this debate before. I still stick to my view that I think there has been a psychological shift in the way we think about foreign policy thanks to the way Labour has talked about it. I don't disagree, however, that there was no ethical component to Tory foreign policy. To Oliver, I would say I have never heard before the Iraq war suggested in this country as being part of a Middle East policy against terrorism. If it had been, why the hell didn't they overthrow the regime in Riyadh and instead of the one in Baghdad? If you want to look for the causes of the terrorism, you look to our allies. I was disappointed to hear you both defend, both the Malcolm and you, defend our relationship with Saudi Arabia. It seems to me that you read the 9/11 Commission report, the causes of terrorism are to be found right there in terms of a despotic regime that abuses the human rights of its people. Most of the ruddy hijackers were Saudis. The suggestion that getting rid of Saddam, who was vehemently anti-Al-Qaeda, who suppressed all kinds of Islamist opposition in his own country, was somehow part of a broader theme of promoting a democratic Middle East and thus combating the gravest threat we face, which he also interestingly placed geographically, when in fact the only terrorist attacks in this country have come from people living in this country, which I think points to the complexity of the problem and the lack of sense in talking about terrorism as purely a foreign policy issue. I'd like to come back to Malcolm on Kosovo, but I think I've had my turn.
Well, there are a number of points that I'd like to take up. First, it is a criticism of me that I did not, in fact, mention Saudi Arabia in my comments. Malcolm did, but I did not. And let me briefly respond to that. I think that there are very many criticisms that you can reasonably level against New Labour in foreign policy. And one of those, and it is in print, you can see my comments on the BAE scandal with reference to Saudi Arabia. I said it gave cynicism a bad name, the way that the Blair government had behaved in the matter. There are trade-offs you make in foreign policy. I certainly take Malcolm's point that you do not needlessly antagonise allies of an autocratic nature whose support you receive in counter-terrorist activity against far more potent and directly threatening forces. But that doesn't obviate the need for, you may mock this term, but it doesn't obviate the need for gesture in foreign policy. And let me indicate what I mean. The late President Gerald Ford was not a great president by any means, but he was unfairly maligned for two particular reasons. One is, despite his great athleticism, he was a physically very clumsy man. And secondly, much more important, he was given extraordinarily bad advice by Henry Kissinger in 1975, not to receive Alexander Solzhenitsyn at the White House, lest it be provocative to the Soviet Union. It is pretty much what one remembers about Gerald Ford, despite the fact that he was the president who presided over the Helsinki Final Agreement that really did give encouragement to Soviet dissidents labouring under a
what we now know was a transient despotic regime. The issue of symbolism, if one can call it that rather than gesture, in foreign policy really does matter, and I would accept that it is a fault of the Blair government not to have indicated more strongly the differences it has with the Saudi regime. There is, it's not merely an autocracy, it is a fiefdom. There aren't many regimes that own the country in which it is instilled. And the symbolism of foreign policy is something that you can certainly press, aware of the diplomatic costs of not doing so. To give another example very briefly, our relations with China. There is not a senescent gangster regime in the world going, if not quite from A to Z, then at least from Burma to Zimbabwe, that is not supported by UN by a vote by China at the UN. And an indication that China will face diplomatic criticism rather than diplomatic acquiescence seems to me a very important part of foreign policy with an ethical dimension.
Just briefly, on the gesture point, of course you're right, Oliver, gestures are important. Sometimes, however, you can combine gestures with realpolitik as well. When I was foreign secretary, the Dalai Lama was in the United Kingdom, and my advisors did not want me to meet him because it would upset the Chinese, particularly at a sensitive time with Hong Kong. I was determined to meet him. We achieved a compromise. I did not receive him at the Foreign Office. I received him in my official flat at Carlton Gardens. Honour was satisfied. The British Foreign Secretary had met the Dalai Lama. That was very important as a gesture. But the fact that we did it in that particular way slightly downgraded its official significance and helped us with our Hong Kong negotiations. Now, I'm not saying that was some miracle solution. I'm simply saying you actually have to have lateral thinking to try and reconcile the political point you're trying to make with the other wider interests you're trying to advance.
I'd love to let this discussion go on a lot longer, but then nobody on the floor would have a chance to come in. Can I just raise perhaps one other issue, which I find very difficult in my own mind? But when we're talking about BAE and Saudi Arabia, and we're talking about ethical foreign policy or policies with an ethical dimension, how much account do we need to take of other countries that don't take quite the same purist view and who are sitting there waiting for us to be ethical so that they can then move in and take commercial advantage of it? And there is there an element of real politique which I think somehow has to be factored into the equation, and I'm not sure that we've dealt with that, but perhaps we can't deal with everything. Can I just make two comments? I was very interested to hear that Khan had been the speechwriter for Malcolm Rifkin. It must have been a very frustrating thing because Malcolm never used notes when he spoke. And so you can disclaim all responsibility. I'm going to open it now to the floor. Can you introduce yourselves, say who you are, and I'll ask the panel to respond to your questions or points. Bruce.
Bruce Allen. As I understand, the major stakeholders live together, and that's never been truer on the relationship between ethics and reality and foreign policy. And I think we've had a number of examples of this today. Oliver says quite rightly that just in a moment when Africa may have discovered economic realism and good government, the Chinese are coming along and willing to prop up every African regime which would supply them with raw materials. So he'd have us criticise China as it falls. Be totally counterproductive. The Chinese have a litany of grievances against the West going back 150 years. They have their version of Western history as kind of rapine and exploitation of subject peoples. If we criticise them for trading with African countries, we'll get all of that. That really is a case for quiet, civil diplomacy with no megaphone diplomacy at all. And if at a crucial moment of that quiet, civil diplomacy, the Dalai Lama, a man I've met once, and he's a man of numinous qualities, a man to revere, if at a moment of that quiet, civil diplomacy, the Dalai Lama came to London, I think it necessarily shunned. Possible and the Balkans. First of all, nothing is necessarily wrong with ethnic cleansing as long as it happens in a reasonably unmurderous fashion. The Balkans would be much easier to manage now if it was three distinct ethnic groups. Second, we were right, I think, to intervene. They cannot live together, Carl. You may think they ought to. You may, with your Boy Scout view of foreign policy, go along and say, look, chaps, it'd be terribly nice if you all got on with each other. When they cut each other's throats. And it would be better if they lived apart so it would be easier to prevent them cutting each other's throats. maybe in 50 years when we make a book, come back to them. But one of the reasons the Balkans eventually came right, as one of the reasons Lebanon has occasionally come right, is that sometimes people get fed up, and not even Northern Ireland as well, people get fed up with bloodletting. It wasn't the various ineffective Western interventions. It was the fact that the locals had lost enough blood, so were feeling a sense of geopolitical exhaustion. There's a, you criticise, you make the easy criticisms, Carl, who are obviously in Bosnia. If you read the record, I should quickly, one of them, we completely distrusted the Americans. Who can blame us under Clinton and all that? They were all for starting ventures in the Balkans, and they were ready to get within 20,000 feet of those Balkans. We had troops, Malcolm and I visited some of them once together, surrounded by nominally superior forces and superior weapons. And the Americans were ready to start a general conflict. They wouldn't, for a very long time, they were never going to put, nothing but one boot on the ground to help the people have to fight that conflict. Iraq, I happen to agree with Oliver. I think we were right to fight the war. We made a cack-handed business of doing so. We were far too idealistic, but I think we were right, and it was about trying to produce a better Middle East. As for our friends, I'll be very, as for our friends in Saudi, Pakistan, elsewhere, we should be pragmatic. You can't have a general principle, a general theory of dealing with autocratic states. You just ask yourself, is this state more or less likely to evolve in a good direction? And I think that Saudi, the answer now is yes.
Thank you very much.